Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 24th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday, folks. You know what that means? Wrong. It usually does mean that, but today it means Digby will be joining us. Also on the program today, via phone, Kelly, can you confirm?
Yes.
We are going to be talking to our new intern. I'm not going to say his name. Because long time listeners, not even of this program, but of my second Air America program out of four or something I did, the Sam Cedar Show, in 9 to noon. We had a caller. It's not Dewey. Dewey is not our intern. It's someone else. Also on the program today, Brexit. Brappened. It's Breel. I don't know. I should have come up with a...
Why don't you run that by me next time?
Michael, why don't you stop trying to centralize freedom?
Okay. Why don't you stop exploiting people who might be a little emotionally troubled for our show content?
Also, Bernie Sanders says he will be voting for Hillary Clinton. And also on today's program, I am a despicable person. Found that out yesterday?
Yeah, how did you take it?
I was up all night. More about the centrally planning freedom. Meanwhile, Donald Trump in Scotland, the incredible capacity for Scottish people to insult Donald Trump is really admirable.
They're unparalleled.
Yes, it was excellent.
Got it unlocked.
Also on the program, Dems claim that their sit-in is just the beginning. Speaking of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton now leads in a poll, not just in Utah, but in Arizona. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Starting late today, my daughter graduated from elementary school. That's the sound of the horn. Matt, it's right here. Yep. I remember my elementary school graduation. It was just the end of elementary school. And then we went on because graduating? It's unbelievable. It was nice, but let's be serious. I've been to like 10 graduations for Myla. She graduated preschool. She graduated first grade. She graduated. It's ridiculous. It's kids today. The Brexit vote is, a lot of people are freaking out. And, we'll talk to Digby about it. I don't know that really anybody has a notion of what's going to happen. We're going to have somebody else on the program. I would recommend that you go back and listen to the interview we did with Matthias Matisse, and just get a sense of what the potential implications are. We will have probably in a week or two another guest on when the dust settles a little bit. But predominantly, What you saw were 56% or so of people who've supported the Conservative Party in the past, something like 95% of the people who have supported UKIP voted to leave. Those were basically conservative through full-on nativist reactionaries. And the left side of the spectrum voted pretty substantially to remain. Youth voted to remain. The older you got, the more your propensity was to leave. And you saw this in particular with, like, pensioners. I mean, basically people who have been screwed via austerity and nativists who xenophobes. And, you know, this is obviously a massive failure, I think, of British elite and perhaps the EU. But I would say more so, you know, British elite right-wing policies, particularly following the crash. And, you know, we'll talk to Digby about it a little bit. I don't know how much more she'll have to say. But I think this is going to have less implications for Britain long-term than it will for the EU. In other words, I think, you know, we could be seeing, we could look back in 5-6 years from now and say that was the beginning of essentially the end of the EU. And then I think then, you know, we're dealing with some perhaps potentially significant destabilization in that region. But we'll see. Meanwhile, I should also thank, maybe we'll play this a little bit later, but John Benjamin, you know him as the voice of the Majority Report, I believe. Maybe you know him for other... But John Benjamin did a sketch on Amy Schuster. Inside Amy Schumer, sorry. And it was sent to me. Oh, that's great. It was sent to me, I should just say. I just want to give a shout-out to son of lawyer Matthew, who you may also know as a young comedian Hen. It's in Henry. And he's over in Europe right now listening. So I want to shout out. I appreciate your sending me that link along. I send to him to Europe. He's in Europe right now, traveling around, and I send him there to send me links to U.S. Comedy Central programs.
With the typical Cedar efficiency.
That's exactly right. Here's one thing that you should we should listen. So one of the things that was told to people is that, look, all this money that is getting sucked out of Great Britain and going to the EU is going to be routed to the National Health Services, to the NHS. And here is Nigel Farage, the leader of UKIP. I'm probably mispronouncing his last name, Farage. On Good Morning Britain, just literally... I don't know, moments, hours after the vote is settled. Here he is, sort of, well, he wants to reinterpret that promise.
£50 million a week we send to the EU, which we will no longer send to the EU. Can you guarantee that's going to go to the NHS?
No, I can't, and I would never have made that claim.
17 million people have voted for Leave.
Yep.
Based, I don't know how many people voted on the basis of that advert, but that was a huge part of the propaganda. You're now saying that's a mistake.
We have a £10 billion a year, a £34 million a day feather bed. That is going to be free money that we can spend on the NHS, on schools, or whatever it is.
But you're not guaranteeing that that money, as promised, will go to the NHS.
You must understand, I was ostracised by the official Leave campaign and did my, and as I've always done, did my own thing.
Do you think there are other things that people will wake up this morning and find out aren't going to happen as a result of voting this way?
Well, I tell you what they will find out, that we're back to being a normal country, in charge of our own laws, and able to start making our own relationships with the rest of the world, maybe even re-engaging with the Commonwealth and the real friends we got out there.
There you are. So, take the good with the bad. We screwed you. Suckers. And now, Great Britain, you'll get that sort of Trump light. What's his name? Boris Johnson.
A lot smarter, a lot more shrewd than Trump, so more disturbing.
There you go. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Digby.
summer sun a runner through the weather that I'm under for the feeling that I lost today. Summer sun a runner for the feeling that I lost today. Summer sun a runner through the weather that I'm under for the feeling that I lost today. Summer sun a runner for the feeling that I lost today. You must be somewhere in London. You must be loving your life in the rain. You must be somewhere in London, walking every lane. I don't even think to make. I don't even think to make. I don't even think to make corrections. Famous angels never come through England.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure. For us, it's sort of like an ongoing pleasure. Occasionally on a Friday, Cliff goes on vacation or has kids, and we get to be joined by my one of my all-time favorite bloggers and writers, Heather Parton, or you may know her as Digby. Hello, Digby.
Good morning, Sam. How are you?
I am well. Thanks so much for joining us. It is my understanding is you've been watching CNBC just to see how much they freak out this morning.
Well, it's whenever there's something like, you know, what happened yesterday, obviously, we're talking about Brexit, and you know that the markets are going to be in turmoil. It's always fun to watch CNBC just simply to see the reactions of the market mavens. And, yeah, they are predictably rattled this morning for obvious reasons. I think the Dow's down 500, which isn't, you know, that bad. It's like a 2% drop. Could be a lot worse. But, you know, I think the thinking is that we've just undergone something of an earthquake, and I don't think anybody knows what it actually means or how it's going to play out as far as the rest of the world and probably in England itself. There's a lot of, you know, discussion about Scotland and Northern Ireland and how this affects their varied approaches to this, Scotland in particular being, very much on the secede side, and perhaps this is going to push them over to do it, to try it again, and it'll win this time. So it's an interesting morning, and of course the, I don't really think we needed a financial market earthquake personally. I just don't feel like we actually needed to do that, but apparently, the Brits barely, it was not a massive landslide by any means, but they decided that it was time to shake things up. So we're getting shaken up. Everybody is.
Yeah. And I want to, in a moment or two, we should pivot to, you know, what the prognostications about what it means in terms of this election. I mean, I think, and we'll talk about Donald Trump. I mean, I think the one sort of beautiful aspect of anticipating that Donald Trump's going to capitalize on something is that, again, Donald Trump is Donald Trump, and and normal people are normal people. And so what he might have been able to capitalize in a Republican primary doesn't work in an election that involves normal people as well voting. But before we get there, it's interesting because there seems to be like sort of multiple ramifications for this. And I know that you read a lot of the same people that I read, and there's a lot of people who just have no idea what's going to happen. But it definitely feels to me like what's going on is, you know, in part, obviously, anti-immigrant. And, you know, we're reading this from afar, but also a function of like the way, I mean, I just remember reading coming out of 2008, all of the horrible austerity stories coming out of Great Britain, really, I mean, up until, I mean, very recently. And it seems like to a certain extent, that has caught up with the country, and they may have been laying the blame in the wrong place, or maybe not, but it It's a little bit scary to me because it seems more where the real long-term implications could be in the rest of Europe in terms of whether or not the EU actually sort of survives as an entity going forward 5-10 years down the road.
Well, yeah, I mean, first, let me just say up front that I am anything but an expert on this particular topic, but I read, you know, what everybody else reads about this, I assume. And I have to agree, just in general, that what I think we're seeing, and we're seeing it here as well to a lesser extent than we are in Europe, which was hit, you know, with much more substantial austerity programs than we were hit with in the U.S. We happen to have, you know, a Democrat in the White House who, you know, at least mitigated the harm of right. austerity in a way that in Europe they just went for it. And it is not surprising that is going to create a reaction. And the thing that strikes me about it, and I think we talked about this once before, which is that, you know, these things tend to have a bit of a delayed reaction. People are in, you know, you're sort of paralyzed when you're in the middle of something like this. I mean, we know what it's like to be in a deep recession. And, you know, I remember my grandparents talking about the Great Depression, where there's just a sense of I just need to get from day to day here. I can't really think about the bigger picture. But once it starts to be relieved, the pressure's taken off just a little, you start to go, wait a minute, you know, what the hell just happened here? And I think that that's just sort of a mass reaction to what went on. And it's not surprising to me at all in Europe. I mean, we look what happened in Greece. I mean, it was a similar kind of problem. And certainly the people, when it was put to a referendum, they didn't vote for Grexit, but they did vote, you know, against all these austerity programs. And, you know, this is I think you're right that this portends something fairly ominous for the European Union project, and a lot of that is to do with their own kind of willingness to, you know, stick it to the people and say, you know, to do this kind of take your medicine sort of policy, which many people, including you and me, we were watching it going, what are these people thinking? You know, you can't do that. You can't just sit there and say, well, everybody's going to have to suffer in order to, you know, bring right things. That's just the way it has to be. I mean, you would think Europe, of all places, would understand that there are severe ramifications to those kinds of policies. They did it before, as we all remember. After World War I, and it didn't work out really well. So, you know, I have to assume that, you know, I mean, obviously this is not exactly that kind of situation, but it's not dissimilar, really. And then you combine that with the crisis in the Middle East, the immigration influx, and, you know, you have the scapegoat available, which apparently in Britain was taken up. I mean, I was watching this guy last night on the BBC, Nigel Farage, who was kind of led the Leave campaign. I mean, he is a piece of work, this guy.
Well, according to him, we just played an audio of him saying that he had been sort of squeezed out on the Leave campaign, which was his way of distancing himself from mm-hmm. the promise that all this extra money was going to go to the NHS.
Right.
But go ahead.
Right. That wasn't his doing, he says. Right. But, you know, he also gave, which I thought was funny. I put that up on my blog, actually, that clip, because I'm sitting there going, you're kidding.
Right.
Within minutes of the polls closing, this guy's saying, hey, we were only kidding, you know. But nonetheless, the true thrust of the Leave campaign, at least towards the end, was evidently, I mean, it was a strong xenophobic anti-immigrant push. I mean, just hardcore. And, you know, that may be what turned the tide for it because, you know, it was neck and neck. The poll, you know, it's close.
Right.
And this, you know, this idea that, you know, here you have an economic crisis. You've got people sort of in an ongoing sense of, you know, I don't want to use the word malaise, but it's close enough. But, you know, things just, you know, not going well. And a lot of this vote, by the way, I mean, London, where the cosmopolitan types are, they didn't vote. They voted to remain. But it was, in the rest of the country, in Northern England, working class, you know.
The heartland, if you will.
The heartland. They voted to leave. And, you know, so you had this economic stress that was inflicted on these people over a long period of time. I mean, it really was years. And, you know, that takes its toll. And then you had this immigration crisis with a perfect scapegoat, and right. This is what you have, you know. So, I mean, that's my simplistic version of what happened. But I don't really think that it's completely wrong. I think when you get right down to it, you know, Occam's razor says that, you know, it's economic hardship combined with xenophobia, and this is the kind of stuff that you get. And God only knows what. And they shot themselves in the foot as well, because I can't imagine that those working class folk in Britain are going to come out on top. I just have a feeling they're going to be big losers in whatever happens now as well. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that remains to be seen to a certain extent. You know, I think there's it's quite possible maybe the, you know, sort of neoliberal conservative governance that has been sort of aggressively creeping in, those aren't the right words, but into Britain will at least have to be owned a little bit more, right? I mean, you won't have this sort of fig leaf of the EU to argue that we need to institute these policies on some level. I don't know. I mean, I'm with you. I don't know enough about British politics. But I wonder also, just to sort of like, you know, pivot across the Atlantic, as it were, do you think, I mean, there seems to have been such surprise about this, and there was such assuredness, I think, on the part of the sort of the Remain and the elite that this was not going to happen. I wonder if it impacts our politics here. Like, you know, if I am someone who, it seems like it really was a shocking surprise to, let's say, David Cameron. I mean, obviously, completely out of touch, right? I mean, to have offered up this vote thinking this is going to be a slam dunk, and now it's basically he just more or less installed Boris Johnson into his old job. I wonder if there is a sense, you know, just even in the States that, like, wow, you know, if I add up what happened, add up Brexit, and we should say, you know, who knows how that's ultimately going to happen, you know, if they're actually even going to leave. I mean, it's not even necessarily mandatory binding the resolution, but we'll see. But when I see that, and then how well Bernie Sanders did, and the fact that Donald Trump, you know, perhaps the flip side of a certain coin of like when people are suffering, some people choose to blame, you know, people who of a different skin color, essentially. But I wonder if that it's actually going to sort of influence our politics more broadly here or not. I mean, I think we're already seeing, like, you know, Bernie Sanders' impact Clinton's campaign in many respects. She gave a speech yesterday that didn't get a lot of attention for obvious reasons, I think. But where she was doubling down on a lot of sort of the more progressive aspects of her campaign. What's your sense of that?
Oh, I don't doubt that at all. I mean, I think it's I think that this is a worldwide reaction, and to, you know, to one degree or another. I mean, I think Europe has a far bigger problem than we do for the reason that you stated earlier. I mean, they inflicted very, very harsh austerity programs on the southern part of Europe and you know, all of it, really. I mean, I think the Germans got off without a whole lot of mm-hmm. problems. But, you know, this was a very ugly policy that went on for a really long time. I mean, you know, 7 or 8 years of that stuff. I mean, that really takes its toll. That's an entire generation's dreams being dashed. You know, you can't make those years back. And you know, so and here, you know, we had much of the same. I mean, in a much luckily we had Barack Obama in the White House. Imagine if it had been John McCain, we would have done the same thing that right. they did in Europe. I think the fact is, I mean, yes, we were gridlocked, but that's a good thing compared to what would have happened if they had actually had the power to right. do what the EU did. So, you know, but the same, you know, the same strain of just, you know, anger and distress at the policies that, you know, and it's not, I think it's more of this sort of an inchoate rage at the fact that the rich got richer. I mean, we saw that, you know, the sort of rise of that with some of the movement like Occupy. And, you know, this has been building for some time. In fact, you can even go back to the late 90s and go to the globalization protests right. and things like that. You know, this isn't something that just sort of sprang out of nowhere. It's been building, and it does seem to be reaching critical mass. If the United States is smart, and, you know, in many ways they were. I mean, you know, Obama foolishly did try to, you know, make compromises, but he was unable to do so, luckily, because the right wing had gone so nuts. Hopefully Clinton will have learned from that and recognize that, you know, this day is done as far as, you know, I think for the next decade it's rebuilding. They cannot, these neoliberal policies, the impulse, you know, to loosen regulations and make things, you know, and open up more and more markets to the benefit of these, you know, of the wealthy rather than the people, and ignoring that whole side of it and just assuming that all, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. That's just not realistic, and it's going to cause a problem. And so, you know, if Clinton is smart enough to actually feel that and respond to it, positively. I mean, she's not going to be a revolutionary ever. She's not a radical. She's a mainstream Democrat. But to understand where that, you know, that their energy that's on that, you know, hopefully, you know, this will be a positive effect. And sure, I mean, she had to look. I mean, everybody looked at what happened yesterday in Britain and kind of went, whoa. And, you know, they did seem surprised. I think some of that, though, came from the really smug, arrogant assurances of everybody in England
right.
who was saying, hey, no problem, hey, we got this one in the bag. And then, you know, but maybe that shaken up that assumption. And, you know, certainly I would hope that Democrats would look at that and go, you know, let's not get too smug about Donald Trump here.
Right.
Because weird things happen. And that happened, and it could, you know, yes, that could happen here, even though he's a circus clown and a, you know, an authoritarian demagogue. Let's not take for granted the idea that everybody's going to see it that way.
Well, give me your sense of. I mean, it occurs to me as you're saying this in terms of what Hillary Clinton's in the event that she becomes that she beats Donald Trump, you know, how she's going to enter the White House in terms of dispositionally. I mean, you and I have been talking, you know, throughout the Obama administration. Oh God! I just but over the course of the Obama administration, you and I would have conversations about how, and we could track it. You know, Obama went through his austerity phase for a couple of years, and then basically, I think however that happens, you know, internally, the Obama administration sort of realized like, oh, that was a huge mistake. Like our first 3 years, we were under these delusions and we just had the wrong strategy because we just had no sense really of what the terrain was. And I'm sure it wouldn't be hard for us to go back into our conversations and find like, how is this not obvious to them? Right. Like, I mean, I just remember us saying that, you and I specifically saying like, how is it not obvious? How could Obama have entered the White House thinking that the Republicans were going to do anything other than what they were doing? And then there was that sort of that interview with Dan Pfeiffer that that we reference quite a bit as well, where Dan Pfeiffer basically concedes that point. Like, yeah, we thought for a couple of years that we could actually deal with the Republicans. And it took us like too long to realize that we couldn't. I wonder, I mean, I find it more comforting for me to just look at the politicians that we elect as empty vessels who respond to different types of incentives and disincentives and then act accordingly. It seems to me that regardless of what anybody thinks about with Hillary Clinton, she must see what the terrain is. And when you get the all these other factors, then plus like what the Democrats did in this week in the House, like the idea that the Democrats would do a sit-in, like, I didn't like that bill. I think that's a crappy bill. I wouldn't do that. Fortunately, I think the best thing to say about that is that it's not actually going to happen. Tie it into the terror list and the watch list. I just think that I think anything that edifies that law is bad. I have no problem with people not getting guns. I think everybody should not get guns for any reason, frankly. But to see that tactic is very encouraging to me. And it also just makes it like there's this mountain of evidence and forces that would make it almost impossible for Clinton to maneuver in the way that, let's say, Bill Clinton did.
Oh, I don't think that's possible. I think that it's a completely different world than it was in the 1990s. I mean, you were there, I was there, we watched. I mean, it was that they were the Republicans were ascendant. They were still building strength at the time, and it was a very different terrain. The Democrats had just lost the Congress for the first time in 50 years. They were walking around like a bunch of blind salmon. They didn't have a clue on how to be an opposition party, and they never acted like one. It took them, literally, 20 years to figure out how to be an opposition party. I think my feeling is, and I have no way of knowing, really, but my sense is that Clinton has always been sensitive to whatever the changes are in the political terrain. I mean, this is one of the things that people hold against it, right? That she's been a political weather vane who, first she was a left-wing radical who sold out her principles for the, in the right-wing ascendance, and then, she became a hawk, and then she was a, whatever. But, that's one of the raps against her.
Well, that's my sincere hope. That she is blowing right now.
Well, and I think that, to be honest with you, I mean, that's kind of, the way democracy is sort of designed is that, to be responsive to the people. Now, that obviously has a downside. If you're Hitler, being responsive to the people isn't exactly a good thing. Or, if you're Donald Trump. I don't have any reason to believe that Clinton's essential value system is fascist or toxic in that way. So my assumption is that she is. I mean, if you look at the way that she has responded, and I mean, in fairness to her, she had come pretty. She had moved to the left even before Sanders entered the race, and then willingly moved even further as the race went on, and never abandoned it. And I haven't seen a lot of signs that she's going to, not yet. I mean, despite the fact
I don't even see the logic of her. I can see the logic. There's that classic logic, like, right, you run towards your flanks during the primary, and then you go to the center. But there's not going to be any. The ideology is going to play so little a part in this general election,
exactly.
It seems to me.
It's not important.
To the extent that it is, it's only to make sure that your base comes out first, and then you're just going to pick up people. But I think, here's my perspective on it. It's like, she's not going to lose anybody who would possibly vote for her because of her positions. It's going to be people who are just that center, to the extent that that center is available to her, it is going to be basically fought on the terrain of, is this guy, can you imagine this guy to be your president?
Right.
And then, issues of like free college, it's just not going to come up. I mean, it's just like, he's not going to fight on that terrain. She's not going to have to defend that. It's all going to be able to be, she's going to put out these speeches. We saw that this week, right? She did two major economic speeches this week. One was day one that got any of the coverage to the extent there was just knocking Donald Trump. Yeah. The second one was going out there and basically delivered so that liberal and progressive interest groups could get their goodies and send it out. Nobody covered that. The only time I saw any reports on it were basically coming from email lists. And I think that's the strategy, which I think makes a lot of sense. And so that, her base can hold her to certain things and have certain expectations. But the general is going to be fought on a completely different terrain, it seems to me.
Oh, I think so. I don't, you know, this is, well, and this is a very unique presidential campaign for obvious reasons, for more than just Trump. I mean, there's a lot going on. And I think that her, you know, her approach, it's a very simple argument to make to the American people, which is Hillary Clinton is a mainstream Democrat. She's really not that different from Barack Obama or, you know, John Kerry or Howard Dean or Bill Clinton or, you know, anybody we've ever voted for in our lifetime. Now, we all have problems with all of them in certain ways, but they're not insane, okay? They're not insane. They're not crazy people. They have, you know, mainstream views that we've all, you know, made our peace with in the past in the voting booth. Donald Trump is not. He's something completely different that we've never even, you know, remotely dealt with. That argument to sane people is all she needs to make. It's not, you're absolutely right. It's not really about principle. Now, as far as the base is concerned, there are, you know, I mean, this is an opportunity, right? I mean, you know, pin her down on some stuff, get her, you know, the turnout's going to be extremely important.
Right.
And, you know, they always say this, you know, turnout is everything, whatever. But, I mean, in this case, it really is true. I mean, there could be a chance of people being so turned off by the whole mess that they just decide not to vote. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's theoretically possible. So she needs to make sure that her base gets out. And they probably will because of Trump. I mean, if nothing else, just stopping that guy has got to be, you know, of prime importance. And so, you know, I have hopes that she's elected, you know, if she's elected, that she's elected on a platform of, you know, a good, solid left of center platform with a mandate to do whatever she can to get that done. Now, a lot depends on whether or not she has any coattails and can change the dynamic in the Congress. If the Republicans hold the House, we're still in a gridlock situation, you know, similar to what we are now. The only possibility of that changing, really, is if her mandate is such, if she wins with such a large percentage that it finally scares the Republicans, certain Republicans anyway, to sobering up and deciding that they're going to at least be functional. Frankly, I don't see it.
No way. I mean,
some people may be hoping that, but I don't think it's going
to
happen.
But this goes back to, you know, what we were saying in terms of the same dynamic that when we talk about Clinton not having the same room to triangulate that Bill Clinton did,
no,
right?
None.
That that dynamic is a function of where the people are and the people where she's going to get votes from, right? I mean, so, you know, we can look at Arizona, and apparently there's a poll out today that shows that Clinton's leading Arizona by, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 points.
Yeah.
The last person to win that race and the only one to the president to win in Arizona in, I don't know, 65 years, I guess, was Bill Clinton. And certainly the people in Arizona aren't saying, like, oh, yeah, I definitely... I think they probably are for providing expanded Social Security. I mean, I think a lot of the programs, I just don't think it's an ideological choice, right? I think it's you're getting a lot of probably just people who are just can't believe Donald Trump is actually a nominee. And also, I would imagine a significant portion of the Latino population saying, like, this guy is an existential threat to us. I'm going to vote against him. And I would imagine what's happened with DAPA and DACA, too, will sort of, you know, put a fine point on just how important the Supreme Court is. But just like she is inhibited by the electorate, it seems to me that, you know, as much as Paul Ryan may want to run for 2020, as much as, he's running already his general election campaign or trying to. I think he'll just get taken out if he even attempts to do anything with a Clinton administration or a Democratic Senate.
Oh.
I mean, you know, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, but and he's going to have a caucus that theoretically will have a higher concentration of lunatics relative to the caucus than he does today.
Well, that's right. And you know, I don't, he has no room to maneuver on this. None. I mean, if you read the right wing, you know, email chains and, you know, their blogs and whatever, their right, you know, the fever swamps of the right wing, Paul Ryan, they hate Paul Ryan as much as they hate Hillary Clinton, because he is, you know, a total sellout to everything they believe in. Now, imagine that if Donald Trump loses in the fall, God willing, who do you know, are they going to say, oh, gosh, we really need to be less conservative? We really need to understand that you know, what we need to do is preserve Social Security, and we need to expand Medicare, and Obamacare is not so bad. That's not the lesson they're going to take. They're going to take a lesson that Donald Trump was not conservative enough, and that he is. That's why Ted Cruz would have been a better choice, really, because, you know, at least the establishment types could say, hey, look, we tried, and look what happened. You know, he was a complete dud, and now we really need to move back to the middle. Trump does not make that argument at all for them, and they are going to be stuck with a House, at least, you know, hopefully not a Senate, but it's unlikely that Clinton could take, it would take a landslide of epic proportions for her to turn over the House. But assuming that the Republicans still have the House and Ryan is still Speaker, it is exactly what you say. It's going to be filled with hardcore right-wing conservatives whose lesson they will take from all this is that Donald Trump was a mistake. He wasn't a real conservative. They need to fight for their principles. And if you look at the latest Pew polling on polarization, it just came out this week. Man, I mean, the two parties, they are in. It's like, you know, yin and yang. The people are completely divided. They have absolutely no respect for the other party. The Democrats hate the Republicans. I'm talking about the voters here. And the Republicans hate the Democrats and have no respect for them whatsoever, and basically believe that that the other party is a threat to the country. They actually ask that question. Yes, they are a threat to the country. And majorities of both parties suggested that the other party was that. Now, I personally believe the Republicans really are a threat because they just nominated a fascist, you know, demagogue.
Right.
You know, that's a threat. I mean, Hillary Clinton, not so much. I mean, she's, like I said, she's like a mainstream Democrat that has been out there forever. The only thing different about her is that she's a woman, not a man. But everything else is pretty standard issue Democratic politician running for president. Trump, no. He's something different. So they're the crazy ones. I don't have any problem saying that. But if you ask the Republicans, they loathe Democrats with a passion. So I don't see a lot of opportunity for a Hillary Clinton to, you know, go down to the Congress and chew the fat with the Republicans and come out. You know, it's not going to be Newt and Bill making a deal, okay? It's
right.
That's not going to happen.
We're not going to meet at C Street or wherever it is and, you know, go and talk about the family and have a, you know, some type of, you know, a Christian circle talk, and we're going to hammer out deals. That's not happening this time around. And I would add that not only are, like, the Freedom Caucus types going to say that Trump wasn't sufficiently conservative, but anybody else is going to have to say, because, you know, Donald Trump, you know, sometime, this is the way I think it goes down, is sometime in October, when Trump realizes he's down double digits, he starts getting even more extreme to build whatever post-election empire that he wants to build, right? Like, he wants to go on the Sarah Palin tour, or, you know, create his media empire, whatever it is. That's when you hear people like Ryan, like, you hear all of them abandoning ship because he's gone too far. And then, which also has the added benefit for Trump to set up the I was stabbed in the back narrative, which, if there's any speech that he has written already and is practicing every night, is going to be the press conference he gives the day after he loses, God willing, and blames, and he knows exactly who he's going to blame. He was treated unfairly. He was treated unfairly from the very beginning. He didn't receive the support from, you know, not just the press, but he didn't receive the support from the establishment and from the bigwigs in the Republican Party. And the one thing he's realized throughout the entire campaign is how much we need a third party, but also how much we need an alternative media. And that's why I'm introducing Trump media. I mean, whatever it's going to be. But it's going to be a stabbed in the back narrative, which he is going to, I mean, and he's not going to stop, right? Like, he's not going to go away after the election. he's going to stay in front of the cameras for as long as he can. And it's going to be pretty stunning. Let's just, I mean, I glossed over it a little bit, but let's just take a moment. What do you make of the Democrats doing that sit-in in the House? I mean, it was a publicity stunt, obviously, but I mean, good for them. I mean, that's what politics is, right? I mean, you could say it's a political stunt, yes. But what else? That's sort of the age we're living in. What was your sense of that?
Well, I mean, first, let me point out that there were actually two bills they were sitting in for. One was the obnoxious watch list bill. The other was a universal background check bill.
Right.
So there were two things that they were actually fighting to vote on. Although, you know, they created a chant saying, you know, no fly, no buy. So people sort of assumed that it was all the
rhetoric was like sort of oriented towards, you know, terrorism, which is true.
Don't let terrorists, yeah.
Right. But it was unfortunately got sort of conflated with that terror
watch
list.
Well, you know, for those of us who are civil libertarians, that you know, kind of makes the hair stand up on the back of our neck a little bit. And, you know, I probably had less problems with it than a lot of my fellow civil libertarians just because I don't think guns are an intrinsic right. So I recognize all the issues surrounding it. I hate the watch list. I think, you know, the no-fly list is an abomination. That, you know, there are many, no due process for anything is a terrible thing. But when it comes to guns, frankly, I don't give a damn because I don't think anybody needs a gun. But setting all that aside, I thought it was a great tactic. And it was a reflection of what we were talking about earlier, which is this kind of, you know, movement idea of people sort of rising up against these intractable barriers that just seem to come up again and again and again. The gun issue is a perfect one because this is the NRA and its members are a small minority in this country. They should not have the right to block every reasonable legislation that would make, you know, Americans safer. This is ridiculous. And yet, those two bills wanted to offer them in the House. They would have lost. It's not as if they'd have had the bill that it would have passed and suddenly, you know, Obama's sending out the FBI, the ATF to confiscate everybody's guns. Nothing was going to happen. But they didn't want to have a vote, and they stopped the vote. Ryan did and his pals because they know that most of America thinks that this is ridiculous and they want something to be done and they didn't want to have to be put on the record for doing it. Now, the Democrats just got sick of it and said, hey, you know what? We're not going to let you get away with this. We're going to draw attention to this. We're going to make it clear where we are. We're going to be on the side of the people. 90% of the American people are on our side. And we're going to stage a publicity stunt, do a little political theater here to illustrate the fact that you people are basically defying the will of the vast, vast majority of Americans. What choice do they have? At this point, we've got blood running in the streets daily from gun carnage. It makes no sense. Americans are not for this. They don't agree with it. Nobody agrees with it. Even Antonin Scalia said that there was room under the, quote, individual right to bear arms in the decision of 2008 that finally affirmed that. Even Scalia said there is room for regulation of firearms. And yet we simply can't do anything because Wayne LaPierre and his, you know, gun nut mafia has so much influence that they are able to stymie the will of the people. Now, the interesting thing about this is, and I will be very curious to see what happens, this is the sort of thing that may galvanize Democratic voters to vote on this issue because they will see that there is an actual, you know, you get this feeling of paralysis, right? Like there's nothing we can do. It's like an act of God, you know, it's like earthquakes, gun deaths because nothing ever happens. But maybe this is the kind of thing that will change people's minds about whether or not they can, you know, about voting on the issue and saying, this is what I care about. The NRA people do it. There are a hell of a lot more people like you and me out there who don't agree with the NRA. And if we vote on that issue, they can change things. They can, it can actually happen. I mean, it just is, the NRA isn't that powerful. But they're powerful because people who are anti-gun or, you know, pro-gun safety, they don't vote on the issue.
Right. So, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, that has been my contention for a long time. It is very easy, it seems to me, to get a poll that says 75% to 80% of people believe that there should be far more restrictions on gun ownership. It's harder to get people to say, that's my number one issue. That's my voting issue. Now, I mean, and frankly, I'm one of those people. You know, like, to the extent that I'm frustrated, I would like to see the Democrats, you know, have done that type of stunt. Maybe not necessarily that stunt, and I think that stunt definitely something like guns lends itself to something more dramatic. But I would like to see it on something like expand Social Security, or like food stamps, or like maybe even like maintaining extended unemployment, you know, benefits, like something that that is not so sequestered, something that is more ideological. I mean, it seems to me, you know, and that's not going to happen. I mean, I don't think we're going to see that. Maybe down the road we could, but we're not going to see that right now. I mean, because guns is not. A sensible gun reform is not an ideological stance. There is, I think, for the right, it is a identity issue. I think it's a signifier. I think it's a tribal vote for them. For the rest of us, it's just like, it's obvious. It's just like literally like, yeah, do we want to vote to have the buses come when scheduled or to just come haphazardly? That's not, you know, I mean, honestly, it's like just like it's a completely pragmatic perspective on this.
Right.
So that's my one lament. I mean, I guess, but, you know, they're not mutually exclusive, right? Like they can maybe if they start doing this for that for one thing, they'll get a little bit bolder on others. And, you know, we had Grayson on yesterday from the floor, and I asked him if he thought that if he was worried that maybe the Republicans would become obstructionists now. But the thing is that I think, you know, this is as ridiculous as that sounds to us. That would have been the argument 4 years ago. Right. Would have been like, we can't pull something like this because
absolutely.
This will teach the Republicans that they have license to do this too. What? I mean, next thing you know, they're becoming armed to meetings, town halls about health care.
Well, it's true. And I was struck by that, actually, how little I actually heard that. I did hear it, you know, on the night of the sit-in. I heard some people saying, oh, my goodness, now, look, you know, the norms are being violated. And I'm going, yeah, well, that ship sailed some time ago, guys. I mean, we are in a new environment, a political environment. Again, going back to that polarization idea. And in order to function, we're going to have, you know, our politics is going to have to reflect that environment and operate within it. I, you know, yes, it would be great. You know, we all want to go back to whatever this, you know, allegedly great consensus was, I guess, back in the 50s, you know, except for all the black and the brown people and the women. It was great, right? I mean, it was just great. Everybody could, you know, they all went and had scotches at the end of the day and, you know, they all liked each other and there wasn't all this animosity. Well, you know, this is America, and we
you
have.
You didn't have to do as much child care if you were a guy.
Yeah, you know, it was a lot easier, right?
Yeah,
you could just hang, and you know, it was.
I gotta
say,
it doesn't sound too bad for someone like myself. but be that as it may,
it was the good old days.
That's
for a certain group.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly, but, honey. Yeah, I'll be home at 9 p.m. completely wasted. Have my dinner ready,
have my drink
and I
ready,
hope the
yeah.
kids are asleep.
Yeah, I don't want no kids screaming. I've had a rough day. Yeah, I mean, those were the good old days. But unfortunately, you know, for the people who benefited from those good old days, that's not coming back.
Yeah.
And our politics are divided. And by the way, this is not new. I mean, you know, we had a civil war, for crying out loud. I mean, we're not a country that has not always had some very, you know, serious divisions.
Right.
That's okay. You know, this is what our political process is for, is to avoid things like civil wars. But sometimes it gets pretty tough, and people have to be willing to, you know, get in there and fight for what they believe in, and especially when the other side has become completely obstreperous and has no intention of doing any kind of compromise. You're left with no choice. I think the Democrats waited way too long to recognize this fact.
Yep.
I mean, I think people like you and I, and it's funny, people are starting to go back and look at this as they're looking at the, you know, at the current landscape, that, you know, people like us, 10, 12 years ago, this is all we were talking about, right? I mean,
yep.
We recognized it. We saw that the impeachment at the end of the 1990s and the witch hunts that went on, that they were crazy, that the stolen election was nuts, that the war in Iraq was an abomination, and something was very, very wrong. And, you know, not to say, and Democrats, the criticism that we had for them was their complete unwillingness to recognize this and to respond to their voters and to the same people by, you know, fighting this back. I mean, it was this idea that they were just continuing to carry on in this, you know, good old days fashion where, well, you know, we just got to get together and see if we can hammer out a compromise, and you can't compromise with lunatics. I mean, that just doesn't, you know, that doesn't work. So, you know, here we are. Finally, I think, you know, people kind of recognize, I hope that's true. I mean, I hope people aren't deluding themselves that somehow the Republicans are just going to turn on a dime here.
This fever doesn't break until the patient is 6 feet under the ground, as far as I'm concerned.
But, exactly.
Heather Parton, thanks so much for your time today. Folks, always, always make it a daily habit to visit the Uber blog, as I call it, Hullabaloo. Thank you so much, Digby.
Thanks, Sam. It's so nice to talk to you.
All right, folks. Now, I have this is going to be fantastic. Do we have a Jimmy Reef cake song? We do. We do have one. All right, but let me just, let me heighten the drama here, ladies and gentlemen. Now, many of you, I don't know how many of you, but some of you, listen to the original Majority Report on Air America. And then from that 7 to 10 p.m. slot, the 6 to 9 p.m. slot, I think Janine and I went from 7 to 10 to 6 to 9. At one point, Janine went on to back into showbiz, and I moved to 9 in the morning on Air America, which actually I have to say was my favorite time slot. It was nice. That was fantastic. And we had a couple of regular callers. One was our favorite right-winger, almost like a version of Doug. But I think, to be honest with you, with all due respect, Doug, more fun and more interesting. And his name was Dewey, and Dewey would call in and always sure to please. He would call in. I remember one time he called in and talked about how upset he was that Dick Durbin wore a pink tie on the floor of the Senate, and all of our Muslim enemies were laughing at us. And in fact, I think at the time, if I'm not mistaken, I think I said, you know who wore one last night on The Apprentice was Donald Trump, and that got him rattled a little bit. And that was 8 years ago.
ISIS actually to the pink tie moment.
Well,
that was when it started.
And that was all part of Limbaugh, you know, goes back and forth into this, the feminization of America. And that's what Dewey was talking about. But we had another caller, not a right winger. Dewey would sort of make me sort of feel like, oh, my God, this country is in such bad shape. Then we had another caller, ladies and gentlemen, who would call in, and called in, I think, like 3 or 4 times. That would make me feel like, wow, the future of the country is actually not horrific. It's actually a very positive future. And that caller, longtime listeners will recall, he was from Portland. And his name was Ethan. And he was, at the time, I believe, 13 or 14 or 15. And he would call in, and everybody would be like, holy crap, that kid is extremely sharp. Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, that kid is no longer a kid. Which I think would be obvious if you can do math. And here we are. Everything comes back to that.
Even those of us who can't do much.
But ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to stop right there. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back. We'll hear from our new intern. That's called a tease in radio. In the meantime, let's hear this song from Jimmy Reefer Cake. What is the Jimmy Reefer Cake song of the week?
Tea Party Patriot.
Tea Party Patriot, ladies and gentlemen. Here it is. And then we'll be right back with our movie guest. Well, not really our movie guest. We'll be right back. Okay, here it is.
Okay, kids, here we go. A Tea Party Patriot, short and stout. Listen to him whine, listen to him pout. When he sees an immigrant, hear him shout. Go pick my oranges, get the heck out. Yeah, that's right, kids. They can pick our fruits and vegetables, but then they need to go home. A Tea Party Patriot waving the flag. Conversion therapy so he won't be a fag. The gay is deep inside him, locked up tight. He must repress it with all his might. That's right, kids, any homosexual feelings, you're gonna have to repress them. A Tea Party Patriot waving his gun. He thinks assault rifles are lots of fun. But if he gets all steamed up, we better run. He may freak out and kill everyone. That's right, kids. School shootings are going to be something we're going to have to worry about just a little bit. A Tea Party Patriot drinking his beer. But the stance on marijuana not so clear. He hates the hippies because they love everyone. And they wear their hair long and have too much fun. Oh, goodness gracious.
Wow, that was excellent. I may play that for Saul. That is a... Man. Jimmy Reefer Cake has been on fire as of late. Ladies and gentlemen, head over to allthehypocrisy.com. He's had a tremendous amount of message discipline as of late. And, but also musically, just fantastic. Head over to allthehypocrisy.com and, you should buy, I hope Jimmy's put this together as an album. I mean, for gosh sakes.
It's sort of like, I don't know, like maybe it's a bad example, but I feel like didn't Carlos Santana kind of drop off for a while and then like out of nowhere, he sort of like reemerged. Sort of
sure.
Put some good stuff. You don't like Carlos Santana, Sam?
No, I do. I just don't quite see the...
He's having a creative peak moment right now after maybe a touch of an artistic lull.
I think all artists go through it is just odd to me if I was to say all artists go through ebb and flows of more and less creative times and then you just randomly go, yeah, like Carlos Santana.
I'm confused by how you're confused.
I mean, but. Carlos Santana got so creative that he has a women's shoe line.
It was when...
Well, Carlos Santana dropped off through the 90s and like the late 80s and then came back in like 2000 and had a resurgence.
Started working with Rob Thomas and that's
right.
All he needed.
Yeah. All right. It's not that complicated.
Okay. It's not complicated. It's just, I think that if you were to say to people like, hey, think of an artist who has, had an ebb and flow in their work that... Carlos Santana would come up.
Who would you think of?
Carlos Bob Santana Dylan? Would come up somewhere around, like, I don't know, in the 800s, I think.
So who would you think of?
I mean, you could go through, Ben Affleck. He went away artistically and came back. You could come up with filmmakers and visual artists.
Right,
and
I'm just talking about a fellow musician. That seems there's the obvious parallel there.
Fellow musician to Jimmy Reefer.
Right. Okay. Exactly. There you go.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, enough of that. as I said before the break, we had a caller who called in to the Sam Cedar Show now, I don't know, 8 years ago, 9 years ago? Oh my God, 9 or 10 years ago, probably 9 and 10 years ago, who restored my sense that the future was bright for all of us. and you recall him as Ethan from Portland. Well, Ethan from Portland is no, well, he actually is still, I guess, Ethan from Portland. But he's now Ethan from Portland, the intern. Ladies and gentlemen, here he is, our intern for the summer, Ethan. Ethan, welcome.
Hey, Sam. Hello, everyone.
Welcome back to the show. Long time no call me.
Yeah, thank you. You keep on having a show that happens during my classes and during school, so I keep on not being able to call you. You should really just reschedule every semester when I have new classes so that I'd be able to listen live and be more engaged.
Well, if I knew that you were still out there, listen, I would have rescheduled this. It'd be a 7 to 10 p.m. show.
What do you think happened to him?
Well, no, I didn't know that he was continually to listen. So, Ethan, what have you been doing for the past, what? Now, how old were you when you called into the show?
I think the first time I called in, I'm pretty sure that I was 13 years old.
Wow.
It was like right around the 12-13 border, I think, was the first time I called in to any radio show. And the first radio show that I ever called into, like I called a bunch of the Aramaic ones, but the first one I ever called was your show.
Oh, right. Thank you. I got a little bit concerned where you were going with that. And so in a way, like so, I mean, how often did you call? Have you still been calling this whole time, the past, like, 8 years? You haven't been trying to call Air America shows. The phone hasn't just been ringing and ringing.
There's a little office there that has, like, a long voicemail that's just full of me calling and seeing if I can get there. No, I haven't. After Air America dissolved, I went off and was... I wasn't really following the progressive talk world and where everyone turned up, and I
like Carlos Santana
back in a while,
like Carlos Santana a little bit, right? You went off and then came back.
Disappeared.
Right. Okay.
I tried to make my own shoe.
You finally made it
work out very well.
And so all right. So tell us what I mean. There's a lot of listeners out there who are right now are just they're probably doing they're freaking out a little bit. They're also feeling like, oh my God, I'm old. And then they want to know, like, what have you been doing? So you went through middle school, you went through high school, college, right?
Yeah, I'm in college right now. I took a year off in college because I decided I wanted to, you know, take a little bit of a break from being in school continually, but I'm now in the summer before my senior year at Haverford College outside of Philadelphia, and I'm a political science major. And pretty consistently since middle school, I've been engaged with politics, either in terms of closely following them, sometimes being more of an activist, but especially more recently, trying to figure out, like, what good policies should we be enacting and engaging with things in a very academic, you know, like political science focus. But that's, my life has been a continual stream of academia, as has for the last 9 years of most of my friends' lives.
Well, you're at the age when people do that. I mean, you know, you could end up like new Matt here and be going to school for like another 10 years after that, right? I mean, Matt, are you still, Matt, on like graduate programs? And
I went to 2 years of grad school.
Now Kelly's mad because she went to graduate programs too. And
yeah.
Not including her.
New Kelly went to just as much school as new Matt.
Well, but with all due respect, Kelly, like relative to his life is still dominated by education in a way that, okay, don't, Kelly's mad at me now. Kelly's mad.
Matt has a certain amount of free time that I do not currently have the luxury of.
That's fine.
I mean, it's true, okay? Matt spends his free time listening to Audible. You wouldn't, okay? That's just true, all right? I wrote it down.
Well, I'm also including Matt's
Matt's
listening.
Like Rain Man, okay? It's true.
I'm including Matt's listening to great courses. So
Matt's an information sponge because he's had nothing else to absorb.
So Ian, now what are you looking forward to doing on this program? Listen, we're going to figure out how we can do maybe via Skype, because you're not going to be on the Majority Report campus, as it were. Usually when we have interns, they're staying here and they stay in the Majority Report housing and eat at the Majority Report commissary. But we're going to do an Ask the Intern a show with you. We're just going to figure out how to technically do it. But tell folks what you've been what you're doing on the show so far. I mean, you've only been on this for a couple of days, but
yeah. So I've been with y'all for like a week now, kind of, and I've been working on some social media, like branding stuff. So if there are pictures with good quotes from the Majority Report, then they will be, that are floating around your social media, you should share them and like them and spread the word, and that will be my doing. If there are pictures with bad quotes from the Majority Report that you start seeing, blame my evil doppelganger. I'll also be doing, I think, some stuff with the analytics on YouTube and trying to figure out what more, like what little clips we're going to be putting out and what attracts more attention.
Ooh, look at the brains on Ethan. You're a smart motherfucker, Ethan.
I don't feel like it's
mainly
appropriate
just trying
to
make it so that more people listen to the Majority Report.
Well, I got to say, like, the thing I like about Ethan is he has both Kelly's qualities and Michael's qualities. He has Kelly's qualities in that he's like on top of what he's doing, and then he has Michael's qualities in that he's prepared to blame somebody else if it doesn't work out. It's a combination of the entire office.
Well, I've listened to the Majority Report and the Cedar Show for so long that I feel like it just kind of oozed into me by osmosis.
That's the plan. That's the plan. I mean, there's hopefully, like, this is like the boys from Brazil. Like, hopefully there's like just like there's like 30 or 40 of you across the country who and I haven't come across, really, you're the only one so far, but maybe there's like a couple of others. Have you ever run into a contemporary of yours who has listened to progressive talk radio? Like, do you have friends who you sit around and go like, man, did you hear that yesterday about what they're trying to do with Social Security disability on talk radio? Like, does that happen with your friends?
So actually, I'm going to take this as a chance to call it a good friend of mine, David, who is at UPenn doing cancer research. He just graduated from Haverford. He's an awesome person and should be listening today or in the next couple of days. I don't know if he listens live or not, but I have a couple of friends who do, in fact, listen to the Majority Report.
Wow.
So
that's pretty good.
Not, yeah.
We got to get, maybe we can make shirts like I Know Ethan shirts. Majority Report branding shirts. So what, now, let me ask you this. You know, I get a little bit of sense from Matt and Michael and Kelly about what young people are listening to these days, but you're even younger. What do you consume for entertainment? Like, what do you watch? Do you watch TV? Do you ever watch anything with ads anymore? Or like, you grew up with ad supported media. Like, you know, you listen to the radio, ads would come on. So it's not like as foreign to you as it is to like my 10-year-old daughter, but like, what are you watching? What is hip right now, Ethan?
So one thing that I should warn with any answer to this question I give is that I am the kid who in middle school was listening to Air America Radio. I was listening to terrestrial talk radio I got into it as it was dying out. So
you're suggesting that you're not necessarily the typical kid your age in terms of what you like for entertainment.
I feel like one standard deviation away from whatever the typical person is into, maybe two standards because I'm from Portland.
Right. Okay. Fair enough.
But
tell us anyways.
The only time I run into ads really is when I'm listening to Pandora. If I'm in the car and ads come up on the radio, I'll switch to another station. I am a member for the Majority Report, so I don't run into ads then. Mm.
Yeah, I hope we get a good, I think we got to get Ethan a free membership. If I had any idea, I had no idea.
Yeah, I probably should have emailed you. I would have been able to save $10 a month for.
Wait, Ethan, you don't have. You're not a member?
He is a member. That's
he doesn't
what I'm
have a free.
No, I didn't. Okay, I didn't know.
I'm on it.
Okay, Kelly's on it. She's gonna. Sorry. She's gonna fix your payment system. You're set, buddy.
Awesome. I will take that.
Just, I know what you kids do today. Don't go sharing that stream with all your friends. I don't want to be like looking at this going like, hey, how come we got 4,000 people listening from the Haverford Student Union IP address? I don't want to see something like that going on.
Yeah, tell them to download the podcast.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, so what are you watching on TV? Like, do you watch TV? Do you watch Netflix? How do you you watch just YouTube? What do you watch when you watch something?
So generally, like, there's a couple of shows, Netflix, BBC, and HBO that I go through once in a while. So I'm waiting for Sunday for the finale of Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the next thing that I'm going to go through is I haven't seen Breaking Bad yet.
Uh-huh.
But it's like generally binge-watching things via BBC, HBO, or Netflix. My mode of TV consumption. And once in a while, I'll see a movie with my friend.
And have you seen Battlestar Galactica?
I have not seen Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, my God. Jeez. Have I taught you nothing? Have I taught you nothing?
I'm extremely uncultured. So last night was the first time I ever saw Anchorman.
I don't know if that makes you more cultured now, but... but
I mean, these are my friends won't be yelling at me about it. So
yes, yeah. Well, get off of Ethan's back, you guys. He's got more important things to do, like some data crunching and meme making.
the most important things we can be doing in the 21st century.
Well, I mean, that's all it's going to be. So
yeah.
That's the only thing.
He's doing a fantastic job. You really are, Ethan.
Were you just doing your Trump impersonation?
I don't really have an impersonation. It's impossible not to start talking like that all the time now.
Somebody just IM'd and said that your free member URL is already on a Reddit. It has its own subreddit.
We have to multitask. Have to be on the phone and setting things up.
There he goes. Well, that's probably where we're headed. I think probably in 20 years from now, people Ethan's age will just be. That's the only thing they'll be able to do is memes and YouTube analytic data crunching. Everything else is just going to be performed by robots or outsourced, just like even other daily functions. All right, so. Well, Ethan, this is great, hoping that we will hear from you again as the summer progresses, and that we, get ready for that. Ladies and gentlemen, you should get ready for that. Ask the intern questions that you have of Ethan. Ethan, I hope you're prepared for the onslaught of questions that you will get. So, thanks so much for being on board with us. It's so gratifying to hear from you years later. Makes me feel a little bit old, but I'll get over it. And thanks, Ethan. Thanks for the work you've already done, and thanks in advance for the work you'll be doing in the future. And thanks for coming on today.
Oh, thank you for the chance to be once again a part of the long tradition that I think the Majority Report and you're building. I'm really looking forward to it. And I guess I'll be on to answer lots of random questions from the audience some point in the not-too-distant future.
I love it. All right. Thanks, Ethan. We'll talk to you
later. All right. Thank you, Sam.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Wow. Wow. Can you imagine? I probably, I feel like I must have offered him a job back in the day. I must have. Like, I must have said, like, hey, call me in 10 years. And
I was going to say, you offered a 13-year-old a job.
Well, not to work on the show. For when he was 13, it was just basically to do some, like, sewing and that type of stuff. Just like to fabricating shirts. And other, most of my swag, basically, was what he was doing at the time. All right, let's take some calls. I have, I imagine that we're going to hear from, we're going to be hearing a lot about Brexit. Let's go right to the phones. Droon, you're on Skype.
Hi, Sam, Steven.
Hi, David, how are you?
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. Got you.
What's on your mind?
You saw what happened.
Yes.
I voted to remain, as do a lot of young people. And I don't know. It's the UK is about to fall apart, I think. Scotland's going to go its own way. Northern Ireland is precarious. It's just going to be the England and Wales project. I think London's even precarious, not to the extent that Scotland is, but the UK's position in the world is going to be deeply diminished as a result of this referendum. And I mean, we did warn them. They called us product fear, and it's all completely nonsense. All the warnings are suddenly coming true. I think our stock market was down. Our currency got absolutely battered by the dollar and the euro. I think it's closing towards parity on the dollar. I'm young, so it does feel like an older generation just punishing us over and over again.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard that. That refrain that it's a that there is a sense. Why do you think? Just expand on that a little bit. I mean, what do you think? I think there's obviously when I look at UKIP voting something like at a 95% rate for leaving. Conservatives at 56%, more or less, or conservative voters, I guess. Is it just sort of a nativism? Is it a nativism plus like a parochialism? Is it a sense that how much of it is a sense? I mean, I also noticed that like something like 2/3 of people on public pensions, older folks on public pensions, are voted to leave. I mean, how much of it is sort of like a misplaced anger at the EU for sort of austerity policies that probably had more to do with conservative governance?
I think most of it. We have the Labour heartlands, we call them, up in the north. So somewhere like Sunderland, during a general election, it'd come in with the staunch Labour seats, you know, safe Labour seats, and Sunderland was one of the first results we got back, and it was obliterating. It was, I think, 60% to leave, and I mean that should have been coming in for Remain, so. To answer your question about the nativism, I think if you haven't lived in sort of a city, say somewhere like London or Bristol, where I'm at the moment, or Manchester, you don't really get the sense of. I grew up in London, so I grew up with all sorts of people, you know, like the most multicultural city in the world. I've grown up with literally every race and ethnicity possible. So I have literally no problem with it with foreigners. The problem is it's a faceless thing that it's very easy to point the finger at, and Boris Johnson and Gove and Farage picked that out. And I mean, not to the extent that Farage played on it, but certainly Johnson and Gove really, really sort of, you know, hit the right notes. You know, not as enough to sort of get the cries of xenophobia and nativism, but, you know, just enough to sort of tweak it and really, you know, go, yeah, oh yeah, it is them, isn't it?
Mm-mm.
If you get what I mean.
I do. Well, hang in there and, you know, call back in over the coming weeks and just give us a sense of what's happening there. But I appreciate you calling in today. And, I mean, I get the sense that people are, you know, there's a lot of people just sort of in a mild state of shock. And I appreciate your calling in and talking to us about it.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. You're calling from a 372 area code. Who's this?
Good morning, Sam. This is Jesse, a longtime listener, first-time caller. Love your show. I'm calling today about Brexit.
Okay.
I feel like I have a very unique perspective on it, if you wouldn't mind giving me some time on that.
Do tell.
I was born and raised in England in a labor and a trade union household in Liverpool. My parents are somewhat to the left of Bernie Sanders. I don't say that in an exaggeration. It's a fact. I grew up going to trade union pubs and going along the picket lines of miners in the 80s in Thatcher's Britain. So I'm well aware of what working class people have dealt with and are dealing with in those areas. And it's interesting, your last caller brought up places like Sunderland and Newcastle. He makes a very good point, but I'd like to just go over some misconceptions about this vote. And one of the biggest misconceptions is this is primarily based on nativism. It is not. It's definitely a part of this, but it is not the whole. And the whole, to me, as a Labour person who grew up in that environment and background, is Labour's move away from its voting base. That's coming home to roost. You saw it initially in Scotland. When I was 14 and 15 years old, there were no seats in Scotland that were not Labour. The SNP very occasionally won a seat. It was news when they did. Now, well, the results speak for themselves. That is beginning to infiltrate the Northeast, the Northwest, and the working class parts of Britain that for years Labour has taken for granted. We're going to get these votes. We don't need to do anything. That's what produces people like Blair and Miliband having a complete tin ear to their voting base. And I'm not saying that the Brexit vote was the right thing to do. It wasn't. I was against it. I was thoroughly against it. But this comparison that is now being made to American politics is complete silliness. It is just not the same. The British voting electorate are very, very different. I'll give you a prime example. My dad is a full-blown atheist, a left-wing atheist with a PhD in linguistics that voted for Brexit. How do you stereotype that into a comparison for American voters? You just don't. Religion doesn't play a factor. Cultural and working class ideals in Britain are far different. We have a parliamentary system. It makes it different. And when someone like my dad makes that vote, he's not making it based on hatred and vitriol and ignorance. He's making a logical decision. I may not agree with it, but it's a logical decision. And what? My dad is the model of the Labour voter that has been ignored and disenfranchised.
Well, let me just ask a question and bring up a point. One is just explain to us what I'm not contesting anything here, but explain to us what the logic is. Well, we'll start with that. I mean, what is the internal logic? Because I'm not challenging it as much as like I really have no sense of what it would be.
Well, it comes down to when you look at Blair and Miliband, the corporatists. They have a self-interest to promote corporatism. In essence, it's created this wealth gap where the gap between them connecting to their voters and being able to relate that to the betterment of Britain has, it's just grown exponentially. Then you put into the circles that they move in Europe, and everybody's connected to that. Now, does that make it right? I'd say no, but it's a stigma that's attached to all these European leaders. Basically, as a working class person in Sunderland who doesn't have a job anymore, is struggling to get by, and has been continually told by Labour and European leadership, just vote for us, we'll make it right. And they never have. And they're reaching out for something different. It doesn't make it right, but it's understandable why.
I see. I mean, I see what you're getting at. So there's just simply an association between those politicians who have failed them, and they associate them with the EU. I mean, I think the only and let me just make this point that from the exit polling, anyways, you know, for what it's worth, it appears that something like 75% of Labour voted for Remain. And I guess it's the loss of that 25% coupled with, I guess, the cross section of older folks and conservatives that pushed exit over the top. And I guess, and also I would say, like, do you not see an analog, at least in the sense that in this country, there is this perspective of the Democratic Party also being corporatist in this way. I mean, on some level, the difference is that there's not an outlet really because we have a two-party system, and because we're not having, you know, I mean, maybe the outlet would be if we had a referendum on the TPP or something, but there's not the same outlet here. But there is that same frustration on some level, don't you think?
Yes, but let's put it into context just a moment. Just think about it from this point of view. You're a working-class Labour voter, and I understand what you say about the 75%, but that 75% doesn't entail what is considered basically the Labour base. The Labour base is a working-class man and woman from an industrial part of the country.
Okay.
Stereotypically the North. So you're asking that voter to vote with David Cameron. You see the problem there?
Yeah.
I do. It's fairly, yeah. You just asked them to vote for the Conservative they voted against in the public election. And you have a Labour leader, if you watched him on television, was lukewarm towards Brexit, I mean, to Brexit Remain, to say the least. He was hardly waving the European flag. I mean, yeah, he was on the Remain side, but his enthusiasm was at best tenuous.
Right.
And you put all that into the mix and you begin to see why so many people reacted the way they did. I'm not saying it's right. I'm trying to give you a perspective of why that voter voted that way.
Right. Okay. Well, no, I get it. And I think that, you know, that would explain maybe, you know, a percentage of the vote. And it's and I appreciate it. Thanks so much for the call.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Thanks. It's interesting. Just a heads up. I got about 10 more minutes here, folks. So I may not get to some of the IMs, but I want to take some of these calls, particularly on Brexit. And forgive me, we had to start late because my daughter was graduating and then we're doing some pre-tapes this afternoon. So you're calling from an 832 area code. Who's this?
This is Chris from Houston.
Hi, Chris. What's on your mind?
Calling in. I'm actually at work, so I'm probably going to have to jump off here in a second. But I actually have Doug calling in to the Tom Hartman program, and I got the audio on pause. I got people walking in. But anyway, call in. Just love the show, and I did want to play some Doug audio. And,
okay, yeah, just go ahead. Run it right.
To you guys.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, hold on one second. Hold on one second.
I love the fact that he's got...
Welcome back. Doug, I'm in Little California, watching this on YouTube. Hey, Doug, what's up? Dino Tom, this is about, I really impressed with you today. This is about as objective as I ever heard you commentate. Your analysis has been very objective. There's been this,
I got to run, but it's really good.
Can you email it to us? Email it to us.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks. This show is just like, it's eating itself.
Yeah.
Well, let's see how much we can make it eat itself. You're calling from a 619 area code. Hello? 619 area code. Hello? I can hear you. 619? Going once? Going twice? Bye-bye. I guess we won't hear Doug on Brexit today. You call him from a 559 area code. Who's this?
This is Luis from California.
Hey, how's it going? What's on your mind?
Hey, first I want to thank that previous caller for sharing that little Doug clip with us. That's pretty good. I have a recommendation for you and for the listeners. In the past, you've brought up the topic of how sometime in the 80s, our culture became obsessed with money, or you say like it became all about money.
Yep.
And I don't know if you've been watching or if anybody's been watching the CNN series, the 80s. They've done the 60s, the 70s, now they're doing the 80s.
I haven't.
There's an episode called Greed is Good, which focuses exactly on that thing that you mentioned, our culture becoming obsessed with money and glorifying Wall Street and the birth of credit cards and all that. It's a great episode. And I think they're going to have like a lot of the episodes from the 80s, like a little marathon on Saturday evening. So I just want to tell you and your callers that they might want to set up their DVR so they can watch that episode, because it goes exactly to what you've been talked about in the past.
Oh, great. I appreciate the call. Thanks, man.
All right. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye. This is, should we get this Simon Brodkin? Is this good? Yeah. Well, let's start with this. Here's Donald Trump in Scotland saying that Brexit is a great thing. And then when we come back, I will read off some of what folks had to say to Donald Trump in Great Britain. But here is Donald Trump in Scotland at his golf course, I guess, out there on a, what would you call that? A golf mission. I'm not sure. Okay, go ahead.
Should Scotland leave, sir?
Right. Well, nobody knows. Look, if the pound goes down, they're going to do more business. You know, when the pound goes down, more people are coming to Turnberry, frankly. And the pound has gone down. And let's see what the impact of that has. But I think places like Scotland and England and different places in Great Britain, I think you're going to see a lot of activity. The pound got high and people weren't able to do maybe what they wanted to do. But for traveling and for other things, I think it could very well turn out to be a positive. Nobody really knows. You'll know in about 5 years. You'll be able to analyze it, and maybe it'll take even longer than that. But what is known is that they've taken back their independence. And that's a very, very important thing. Yeah, Kate.
Yeah, there you have perhaps the single stupidest nominee of a political party, at least in modern history, right? I mean, just no clue. I mean, yeah, okay, he figured out like, well, when the pound is down, you may get more tourism to my golf course. And they've taken their independence back. They actually had the best deal of anybody in the EU by far. So here is a tweet that Donald Trump put up. Just arrived in Scotland. Place is going wild over the vote. They took their country back, just like we will take America back. No games. Now, I don't know what the no games refers to. I guess it just means like I'm in golf. I'm in my golf course, and I play a game of golf here, but not in the political realm. That's cute. But the best part is that folks from from Scotland and just all around Great Britain responded to him. For instance, like rated R, *, aid star says, oi, butt plug, face. Scotland are pro-EU. And then you had Megan Stamper right back at Real Donald Trump. Scotland voted Remain, you Muppet. And then you had this one, Claire Woodward. Scotland voted to remain, you tit. And then my favorite would be this one, which is from Tim Footman. Scotland, and this is all in caps. Scotland voted to stay, you witless fucking cocksplat. Which I thought was pretty good. And that was care of Rachel Zarrell on Twitter. That has now over 5,000 retweets. So here is Simon Brodkin, a comedian, apparently, a British comedian. Is he British? Who interrupts Trump's golf course speech in Scotland by dumping Nazi logo golf balls around the podium and saying they're on sale in the clubhouse. It's pretty funny.
J. Trump. These are the new balls available from the clubhouse as part of the new Trump Turnberry range, and I forgot to hand them out before.
That's that comedian, isn't it?
Get them out. Thank you.
There we go. That's pretty good. Also in the news, Corey Lewandowski, the dude who ran Donald Trump's campaign, literally seconds after he was released from the Trump campaign, was snapped up by CNN. And, you know, you were going to get some great insights from Corey Lewandowski on things like... everything really, maybe, except for Trump, because it's quite possible that he, his non-disclosure agreement won't allow him to criticize Trump. So kudos to CNN. They may not have asked that question before they hired him. It may not have occurred to anybody like, oh, maybe, is it really possible that Donald Trump would have? It turns out it is.
Did you sign a non-disclosure agreement when you worked for the Trump campaign?
So when I came on the campaign, thanks first and foremost for having me on. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight. You know, when I came on board the Trump campaign, like everybody else, I said what I would do is keep confidential information confidential. And I signed a document to that degree, and I don't plan on ever breaking that. My confidentiality agreement is such where information that I'd be privy to and private conversations that take place between family members that are not meant for the public audience are going to be held in the closest and strictest of confidence with me. And I think that's my duty and my obligation, not just as someone who signed a document, but more importantly, as a person who has respect for the individual he worked for. So I will tell you that I'm not here to release private information of family members or discussions that took place behind the scenes that the public really has no reason to be aware of.
Right. Okay. So private conversations, but also just in terms of whether you're going to be able to say what you really think. I mean, the agreement that CNN obtained that Trump employees signed says something a little bit more specific than what you just said, Corey. It said, during the term of your service and at all times thereafter, you hereby promise and agree not to demean or disparage publicly the company Mr. Trump, any Trump company, any family member, or any family member company. Did you sign something like that, that said no disparaging?
Let me tell you who I am, and for those who don't know me, I'm a guy who calls balls and strikes. I'm going to tell it like it is, because that's how I've had my entire career. And most of the time, it's been at my own detriment. People who know I'm a very straightforward person. I'll tell you exactly like it is, whether you like it or not. And maybe that's the reason I don't have some of the jobs I should have had or been given some of those opportunities, because I'm a straightforward person. That's not going to change. No matter what I've done or what I've said, if something is wrong, I'm going to tell people it's wrong. If something's right, I'm going to tell people it's right. So there's nothing that's going to stop me from telling the truth, in my opinion, regardless of what that is. And
even
I think that's
when
what the people expect,
bad
and that's
about
what people
Donald
deserve.
Trump. Right. The bottom line that the viewers want to know is, even when it's saying something bad about Donald Trump,
Look, I'm gonna say it like it is. If I agree, if I disagree, I'm gonna come out and tell you this is right, this is wrong, this is my opinion on things, and I think that's what the people have a right to have. My opinion on what I believe is right and wrong doesn't mean you have to agree with me, but I am gonna tell you what I think for sure.
Do you believe Corey Lewandowski?
You know, Michael, I'm glad you asked me that question because I'm the type of person who wouldn't dance around a question that you would ask me. I'm the type of person who, when you ask me a question, what I do is I give you a straight answer. I either say yes or no, depending on what that question is. So I'm not going to dance around an issue like as if I'm some type of dancer.
I appreciate that. So, I mean, and that's obviously why I asked you the question. So circling back to that, would you sort of tend to trust what Corey Lewandowski said there?
You know, I'm glad you said circle, because one of the things that I can't stand is when people dance around in a circle, and that's one of the things I'm not going to do. That's the type of person I am. I'm a yes or no type of guy. I tell it like it is. In fact, that's been one of my problems, Michael, that when people say to me, like, hey, yes or no, and I always answer, I answer what comes right off the top of my head. So that's all I can tell you. Can't get any clearer than that. Also, sign the contract. I'm getting paid either way. So,
love that. And the Trump contract has to mean like everything.
Well, he really grabbed that question by the arm and led it around there.
Oh yeah, do-si-do.
That wasn't the most impressive speech I've seen Mr. Trump give. It's like blows up in Corey, NDA.
Well, and also remember if. It's not just NDA. I mean, I imagine there's a severance package.
Oh, for sure.
Right? Like, his golden parachute's not going to be quite as golden. I'm not going to get through all these IMs. I'm going to jump through them right now, folks, because I only got literally 4 more minutes left. Kyle, it's impressive that Ethan, the intern, has made it through Michael's 6-week hazing program run by right-wing Mandela. Majority Report, Zach. This isn't I am doing an impression of the caller, doing an impression of Michael, doing an impression of Nelson Mandela, doing an impression of Donald Trump. Paul McCartney is the best example of an ebb and flow artist. Beatles, and then solo work, then Wings, then Ebony and Ivory.
So he hasn't really bounced back ever.
Northern Star. This Brexit election has once again demonstrated that expert opinions are not a match to chain letters and myths that are circulated in social media. For example, 48% of the Leave voters believed in the pencil conspiracy, something the UK Alex Jones surrogates pushed aggressively. There were so many lies about Muslim refugees, among other things. If you look at the general attitudes of voters, you can see that your average Leaver shares a lot with your average Trump supporter. Social justice, multiculturalism, feminism, and green values are evil, etc. I will check that out. Jay-Z, well, I'm numb. Now when I walk down the streets of my town, I know that 2 out of 3 people I pass are either insane or immune to facts. We now have an angry, activated populist house bitterly divided. When the Brexiters realize there's no sunlit uplands to be found having empowered the far right. So we're walking into the dark with no plan and buckets of irrationality. Yeah, this is a mess. Neff, you did tell Ethan to get back to you in 10 years for a job. Oh, my God, Ethan. Of course I remember Ethan. How fabulous. He's your new intern. Welcome back, Ethan. She also says congratulations to Mila. Teacher Lauren, I just want to remind my fellow New Yorkers we have another primary on Tuesday, this time for congressional candidates. That's right. 19th District get to vote for Zephyr Teachout as our candidate. Doug Huck, Jimmy Reefer Cake, excellent and funny algebra. Sam, I have a legitimate fear. We now have a crop of young people who believe it's normal to be at war perpetually for presidential candidates to talk about how well-endowed they are on a debate stage before calling everyone a liar. Pretty soon, these things, young people won't have a touchstone to normalcy. Yeah, actually, I'm going to be talking to Andrew Basevich about this sort of ongoing war thing. Christo, congrats to Mila. My fifth grader, Teddy, also graduated today from PS69 in Queens. He's a lifelong fan of Sam and the show. Can he get a chauffeur? Absolutely. This is going out to all those
fifth graders out there.
Doug, Obama's hiding under the desk in the Oval Office in a fetal position because of the rejection from the UK. Sam, it's been over 6 months since Hillary had a press conference. Trump has had 5 since the beginning of this year. The press will be over Hillary about the rejection of her and Obama in the UK. Hillary is weak and fragile. She breaks like glass. When does the indictment come? Chris, RL Garner, Regarding Brexit, according to Google Trends, what is the EU is the second most Googled topic this morning in Britain. Oh, my God. Epish. Q, Michael Right-Wing Mandela. Kelly, a woman of action. She has no need for John Mitchell audiobooks at 2x speed. She makes, not takes information. Chris Lopaco. My mom was right. I'm not good enough to be an intern. Always a bridesmaid, never a bride. I really, really want to be an intern for a progressive show. Do I got to blow David Pakman or something?
That's so wrong.
Is Lopaco in? He's not in college, is he? Lord Humongous. Is the caller saying this is Labor's attempt to get out of TTIP like trade deals? Sweatshop Sam, we need to double the output of these Majority Report totes. Randy with an I, doesn't the outcry and despair from the British youth upset about the vote seem like an eerie foreshadowing of a Trump win? I hope not. Joseph Ballin, Sam, what's your opinion on Brexit? I see leftists divided on the issue. Chomsky and Corbyn supported staying. Tariq Ali, Julian Assange, and Hartman say they support leaving. Isn't the EU an ultra-neoliberal pro-capitalist free trade system they got there?
Not entirely.
Not entirely, and I'm quite sure there was, at least within Britain, a lot of room for maneuvering. But to a large extent, the problem was more domestic than it was the EU. Morella, hearing from Ethan is so touching, it almost makes me cry. Some young people are so amazing, it makes me very hopeful for the future. Bullprog, oh, wow, can't wait to hear about how Tom handles Doug. Brexit results came in the same day as Independence Day. Resurgence comes out. Coincidence? Oh, the movie. Born Blue, so many UK friends like this young caller feeling desperate and doomed. I'm a social media group with a lot of politically astute UK folks, and the shock is palpable, an unthinkable outcome that worries me for the next unthinkable that could happen in November. I mean, you don't want to.
I think we should change the national anthem. Just class it up a little bit. I'm just spitballing, but it's a great idea.
The idea of Trump, trust fund Trump, dialing for dollars is frankly pathetic. He doesn't call people. People call him.
I like the trust fund Trump thing sticking.
All right, let's take one more IM for the week. Callers, I'm sorry. Other IMers, I'm sorry. The International Herald. Doug got through to Stephanie Miller's show. Frangella is subbing. Constitutional Republican. They cut him off mid-sentence about immigrants and assimilating. LOL. All right, folks. See you next week. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice was made. Option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the man